This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting windroserecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Karen Casey, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 123 for May 11th, 2021. This episode features a conversation with the author Karen Casey, who's written a lot of books in the self-help genre. And it was really nice getting to talk to her. A couple months ago, I got a text message from one of the guys in this support group that I host. He's also a very loyal listener. He sent me a reading from a book written by Karen Casey, and it reminded me of this interaction that I had with her years and years ago that was really meaningful to me. And I talked to Karen about that. But when he sent that, it was during the time when I was kind of really seriously thinking about doing this episode with my mom. And the story relates to my mom. And I just knew I wanted to have Karen on the show. And I'm really glad I did. We grew up in towns about 40 miles apart from each other, which I didn't know. Prior to this conversation, our high schools played in the same conference. So toward the end of this, we get into what that was like growing up in sort of in Indiana. We called them cities, but you know, compared to like New York or Chicago, they're more like towns, but they're, you know, sort of mid-sized communities in the Midwest. And there were some special things about it. But anyway, it was a great conversation, and I'm glad I reached out and got her on the podcast. I appreciate her doing this, and I hope you enjoy it too. Here you go, Karen Casey.
Government's prying eye. Take yourself a soma
You know, you and I've met a couple times over the years, but we've never really gotten to know each other or anything. But I just want to give you a little synopsis of my memory of you and kind of where it fits in the context of my life.
Okay.
Okay, so you're a writer and you've spoken over the years at many, many women's conferences, specifically pertaining to recovery, and part of that was a series of conferences called Women Healing.
Right.
Which at its height was a collaboration between the Betty Ford Center, the Karen Foundation, and the Hazelden Foundation.
That's right.
And I started my career in the addiction treatment industry working at Hanley Hazelden in West Palm Beach, which is where I got sober. And I worked in the marketing department there for a couple years, during which time we hosted the Women Healing Conference in West Palm Beach. And, you know, I was about 28 years old, and I had never really had an opportunity to spend time with authors. And I just, it felt like such a blessing to me to be able to do that. And, you know, around the same time, at Hanley, we had hired Stephanie Covington as a consultant to train all of our staff in the women's program, which included me.
Uh-huh.
And so I got to know her a little bit. And then she was, I think, the keynote at that speaker. You were one of the speakers. Raquel Lerner was another one of those speakers who
right.
I stayed in touch with all these years. And I was the young guy in the marketing department charged with, okay, Tom, you're going to videotape all the speakers. And I was kind of the utility guy at this, you know, if anybody needed anything or anything like that. And it was just a really memorable experience for me and a special memory. Lots of great things. One of the things that stands out to me about that is, if you remember this specific conference, there was a building being built next door to the Marriott in West Palm Beach. It was kind of a mess outside the entrance. I now live in that building.
Oh, do you?
Next door to that hotel. So that was about 2001, 2002, something like that. But another thing that happened is, you know, you've written... People listening should know you've written a lot of meditation books, like daily devotional, inspirational readings. And I, you know, they always have a bookstore at these conferences, and you were speaking, and you know, being a sober guy, my mom started going to Al-Anon religiously when I got sober at 23, and I heard you, and I thought, I'm going to buy one of her books, and I'm going to ask her to sign it for my mom. And you wrote something like, yes, I remember you just very, what's her name, you know, and me telling you. And you wrote something like, dear Martha, your son's a testament to what a remarkable woman you must be. And it almost tears me up to think about it because, you know, we put our families through so much.
We do. We do.
And it's been such a gift to me that my mom is so proud of me.
Oh, that is wonderful. And with good reason, Tom, with good reason.
Yeah, yeah. But to be able to give her that, like a memento like that, I mean, it must have been one of her prized possessions all these years. You know?
Yeah.
And so... Anyway, I do a men's group once a week, and you know, we text each other and send each other readings, and one of the guys sent me a reading from one of your books a couple weeks ago, which reminded me of all this, and I thought, I got to get Karen Casey on this podcast.
I'll be doggone.
Yeah.
And what a small world.
Yeah. It is, yeah. And so, you know, you've also written a daily reader pertaining to the Course in Miracles.
That's right.
And
right. That is right.
Which is dear to my heart. And this being, as we speak, it's the fifth Wednesday of the month. And my Course in Miracles group meets every Wednesday of the month, unless there's a fifth Wednesday, in which case we take that off. So instead of being with them right now, I'm with you.
I'll be doggone. Isn't that, I do a group on Zoom every Monday night.
Mm-hmm.
I facilitate a Course in Miracles group in my home in Minnesota and here in Naples for at least 25 years. And now, because of quarantine this past year, we moved it onto Zoom. And so we're still doing it on mm-hmm. Zoom. And, you know, it's just, it is such a core part of my spiritual program, you know?
Yeah.
AA Al-Anon and the Course in Miracles. It's like my life would be a mess without all three.
Yeah. Yeah. And the group that I attend, it's the same thing. You know, it used to be face to face until we were forced to. Well, you know, we didn't have to go to Zoom. We wanted to. You know, we wanted to keep meeting. So,
right.
And it's, you know, I've referred a little bit to the course in this podcast. And, you know, one of the things that I haven't talked about, I guess, that really stands out to me about it. First of all, I knew about it for a long time before I ever went to a group. And over the years, working in the helping profession, it seemed like over and over again, I would meet these people who I had a lot of respect for and admired. And at some point, I'd learn that they were a student of the course.
Mm-hmm.
So then when someone said to me maybe 5 years ago, hey, how would you like to go to this group at this lady's house? And I was all over it. And,
oh, sure.
And, you know, I'd always kind of been looking for an opportunity to do that. And so I went and, yeah, I really didn't know what to expect.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, what I got was showered with love.
Yes.
That's what happened. And it just felt so good.
Right. And, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's... How do you not keep being involved in that?
That's right.
It's really something special, and it's helped me a lot, specifically in my interpersonal relationships.
Right. I think that it can be the core guiding line for holy relationships.
Right.
And as the Course says, every relationship starts out as a special relationship. Right. But special, not in a good way, special in a bargaining way.
Right.
And fortunately, every relationship then has the opportunity to become a holy relationship if the partners involved really seek the guidance of the Holy Spirit.
Right.
And so it is. It's just... it makes such a difference in our lives.
Yeah.
And then it makes a difference in all the lives that we touch well.
Yeah.
You know, another book that I wrote besides the daily meditation book, I wrote about 3 years ago, a book called 52 Ways to Live a Course in Miracles. And in Minnesota, there are lots of groups that, book study groups, people mm-hmm. who are meeting and using that book because there are 52 essays and people are using it on a weekly basis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it has become a really core study guide for a lot of people.
I love that because
yeah.
you know, anyone who's ever looked at the Course in Miracles text, it's dense and heavy.
Oh,
and
it is.
It's, I don't think it's meant to be read by yourself.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that that's the reason I think that course groups, study groups are so important. And I guess that was one of the inclinations for writing that particular book, was just my own, you know, my own realization at how much easier the course might be were those principles given a little bit more substantive explanation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't really know what to expect, but I gave a talk at the retreat in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of mushroomed, and they invited me back for 3 years in a row to talk to a few hundred people each time.
Wow.
And it kind of developed then into these book club groups that meet to study that book. So, you know, everybody is searching for a way to really live more love-filled lives. And you know, I think that the quarantine has really given that an extra boost, because people have felt somewhat lost. And, you know, I think those of us who have been in 12-step groups or course groups or whatever have really been on the lucky end of the quarantine, because we have had this opportunity through Zoom to continue meeting face-to-face.
Well, and you you couple that with, you know, being a member of a 12-step fellowship, kind of, it goes without saying that you've dealt with some adversity.
Right.
And so, you know, there's always a silver lining.
Right.
And for me, it has been fascinating to watch, first of all, because I feel like we all have been searching for something, and a more meaningful way to live, and this shutdown has forced us to reevaluate.
Exactly.
Am I happy? Is this what I want? And now, what saddens me is the people who've gotten angry and I want to get back to normal. Well, you know, like there's a Brené Brown quote out there, like, I don't want normal. I want something new that we create from this.
Right.
That's better. And,
right.
And that's the opportunity it has given us. And, you know, I do this, this group, and, you know, I've had clients who were working in corporate America for 40 plus years. And, you know, I mean, before the quarantine, you know, we're talking through their anxiety related to workplace politics or whatever. And then all of a sudden they're working from home for 90 days. And oh my God, I feel so much better.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't want to do that anymore.
Right.
And I think the luckier of us have that, you know, I mean, I feel bad for the people who don't have those kinds of options, but I think for a lot of us, we get an opportunity to examine what's happening and is this what we want?
Right. And, but you're right, you know, not everybody is so lucky when we think of all of the individuals who are struggling terribly to figure out how to pay rent, to how to keep from getting evicted, how to put food on the table for their young families, because they're essential workers and they don't have the option that so many of us have had. And so, you know, there's been, some of us have had, have found the quarantine comforting in an interesting way, and there are those who have struggled so with it because they haven't been able to find any comfort at all.
Well, and myself, I mean, I have I've worked from a home office since 2010. And, you know, I've a lot of outside appointments, a lot of travel and stuff like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I've worked from home.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't all that foreign to me. It's, you know, there's been some time where I, some days like, okay, you got to get out of the house today, even if it's just to go to Publix or whatever. And I'm,
right.
I like my solitude. So it's been, I mean, I've kind of eaten it up and it's been a opportunity for me to really dig into creative stuff and be
right.
focused. But yeah, I mean, if you're an extrovert, man, this is tough.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, I've always been a fairly social person. Mm-hmm. However, I didn't realize how much I didn't really want always to be that social person. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like I have really been blessed by all of this. And actually, I ended up writing a new book that will be out May 11th. It's already on Amazon.
Oh, my God.
But I was needing, I knew I wanted some new focus. And I also, as we were talking about, you know, the search in our lives always for greater peace, which is why so many of us turn to A Course in Miracles, mm-hmm. I ended up writing another meditation book.
Okay.
And it is a meditation book that's called Each Day a Renewed Beginning, okay. Meditations for a Peaceful Journey. And it really fed my need. It nourished me daily to sit and just allow, well, my writing is really allowing God to work through me. It just nourished me daily to sit in those quiet moments with God and listen to a peaceful message and write it down. So, you know, I feel like there were so many things about the quarantine that really fed me in a way that I had not expected. And, you know, in my relationship with my husband, you know, we're both in recovery and have been. I'm soon to celebrate 45 years. And, you know, it is, I didn't know how much richer our relationship could be until this period of time, until this last year together.
Wow, what a gift.
Yeah, it has been such a gift for Joe and myself and our dog. We have a yellow lab named Nellie, who okay. will be 6 years old April 7th.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it has been just a joy in so many ways. I mean, you know, the quarantine has resulted in such disastrous things when you think about 550,000 people in our country alone dying. I mean, it's just the sadness of that is almost beyond belief. And yet that's juxtaposed with some good things that have resulted as a result, the good things that have resulted in spite of the pandemic. Mm. And so I think it really gives you a reason to pause and remember that within the midst of sadness and struggle, there always can be a light. And some of us, I think, have been showered with the light.
Well, yeah, I mean, so many thoughts. When we go through adversity together, we become closer to each other.
Right. Know?
And the AA big book, there's a, I'm going to butcher it, but, you know, where it talks about we are people who ordinarily would not mix.
Right.
But we've gone through a common peril.
Right.
It mentions some kind of shipwreck analogy. I can't remember exactly, but surviving it together, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
And, you know, just like I've been thinking about, I had lunch with a family yesterday, a mom and dad who reached out to me a little over a year ago to help place their son. And I kind of coached them into getting him into treatment and have stayed in touch with them. And somebody said to me, well, you know, it's really nice that you stay in touch with them. And I wouldn't think of not, you know,
right.
I mean,
right.
we've been through something big together, you know?
Right.
And it matters to them and it
right.
matters to me too.
It, right.
It's just such a gift.
It is,
yeah.
you know, our connections with others, I think are always a gift mm. and we often don't even realize it in the midst of it.
Yeah.
But I in my long journey, long life, mm-hmm. I really have come to believe to the tips of my toes that every encounter I've ever had with anybody was quite intentional for a reason that was important to each of us in that encounter, even though we might not have known it at the time.
Right.
And you know, that's the beauty of hindsight.
Mm. Yeah, so, you know, I've been at this place where lately I'm approaching 25 years of sobriety, which
oh,
just,
wonderful.
Just like, I can't even believe it. You
yeah.
know, I mean, it's just, I would have never thought. And, you know, a couple years ago, it felt like a big deal because it was 23 and I got sober at 23. Well, half my life
yeah,
now,
sure,
I've been sober,
sure.
but 25, man. And, you know, most of that time I've been working with people and, you know, I've always wanted to kind of keep some degree of humility about, you know, seeing myself as, you know, people have called me an expert at times and it has made me really uncomfortable.
Right.
But, you know, 20 plus years, I mean, I'm starting to like become more, wow, Tom, you've really been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
But then you, oh my gosh, you've been sober for 45 and it's just remarkable. It really
Well, you
is.
Know, and for each of us, it's important to actually never forget who we were and where we came from,
mm-hmm.
and how it happened that we got here.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know your journey, but I certainly didn't end up in Alcoholics Anonymous because I chose
right,
that.
Right.
It was really kind of an accidental suggestion.
Yeah.
And I went and I had started in Al-Anon in 1974 because I was really intent on trying to change somebody else's drinking habits, having no idea that
you entered
I was
through the back
too.
Door, as we say.
Yeah, right. And I had no idea that you know, I was a daily Jack Daniels drinker, but I had no idea when I went to Al-Anon that I actually was an alcoholic
right.
too, but it felt so good to be there because it felt hopeful and accepting. It felt like nothing I had ever been to before.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime later when it was suggested by a counselor that maybe I needed to go to AA after she heard a bit about my story. And I walked in, Tom, and I looked around and the place was men and women and they were all about my age. I was just 30. I hadn't even turned 36 yet. And I looked around, though, and I thought, yeah, this is a place for me. Look at all these good-looking men. And I thought, man, was she right? This is exactly where I need to be. And that was, that honest to God, was why I went back. And
because
you know,
of the good-looking men?
Because of the good-looking men. And I had no, from that very first meeting, I never, even though I had been a daily drinker for many years, mm-hmm. I had absolutely no urge to ever take another drink again. And that was totally, felt like a mystical thing. I mean, yeah. It was like, I don't get it. And
well, when you experience that, you know, cravings, and it's just such an overpowering thing to have it be removed. It really
right.
is. It's a huge deal.
It is.
You know, it's funny, the good looking men thing. Over the course of my career, there have been many times when people have said to me, well, you know, he's not going for. In the work context, he's just going to meetings to pick up girls or whatever. and you know what my response has been? So what?
Yeah,
he's
right.
going. He's
yes,
going.
Right.
And,
right.
And, you know, there was an old friend of mine who you actually may have met over the years, a guy named Jim Emmert. Who,
that name's familiar.
Yeah, he worked for the Karen Foundation for many years.
Okay.
But he used to say, you know, there's not a wrong reason to do the right thing.
Absolutely. Oh, I agree with that so wholeheartedly. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But that's funny that whatever, if that's what kept you going, right?
Right.
Thank
right.
God.
Exactly.
Yeah. So now. So you were 36 when you stopped drinking.
Yeah, well, I was, let me see. It was in 1976. I was either 35 or 36. My first AA meeting was May 24th.
Wow.
1976.
So what was it like before that?
Well, you know, as I said, I was a daily drinker. I had been married to an alcoholic for 12 years, you know, and we were had a crazy, disrupted life by alcohol. We married in our senior year at Purdue University. I went to Purdue as an undergraduate. Yeah. I was in psychology, but because we got married our senior year, my counselor, or my advisor, I guess they called him, said, you know, you'll never get a job without a master's, so you better switch into something that will get you a job. Mm-hmm. So he suggested I go into education, and I did, and I became a teacher. I loved teaching. I taught for 8 years. I taught for 3 years in Indiana. In fact, I taught at the same grade school that I had attended as a kid.
Karen, where are you from? What town are you from?
Lafayette, Indiana.
I'm from Kokomo.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
I'll be doggone.
Which is 30 miles away from each other.
Right. I'll be doggone. Yeah, right. Lafayette, Indiana. And I taught at Oakland School.
Okay.
And then I Bill and I moved to Minneapolis because he wanted to go to graduate school, and he had already gotten a master's at Purdue. And so we moved to Minneapolis because he wanted to get a PhD in American Studies, which he didn't ever finish. And as a matter of fact, I then did go to graduate school and did finish mine. Hmm. So, which was a totally unplanned. I had no idea that that's what I would do with my life, which is why I'm so convinced that God always has a plan. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we're the last to know just what that plan is.
Or even realize it needs to exist.
Right. Yeah. Who knew? Except that when our marriage ended, I was really at a crossroads and I kind of thought, what am I going to do? What do I need to do? Because it was a devastating breakup for me. It shouldn't have been because it was a very troubled alcoholic marriage, but I was clearly very codependent and fell into one bad relationship after another. But I thought, what am I going to do? I guess I'll go to graduate school. That kind of thought, well, I guess I'll just go to graduate school. Boy. And so I started graduate school and then ended up getting my PhD also in American studies. But the journey was so strange, Tom, because I had not been a great student as an undergraduate because I was such a party girl. And I had been on probation, in fact, for social probation at Purdue because of my drinking escapades. And so when I started graduate school, even though I was still very actively alcoholic, I miraculously, and I truly mean that, miraculously, was a straight A student. Mm-hmm. And I often think of the promises and God doing right. for me what I could not have done for myself, mm-hmm. because I don't even know how that happened. Yeah. But suddenly everything felt easy. And that's where I really discovered the absolute transformation that writing gave me. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in graduate school, anybody that goes, the thing that they kind of hate most is all the papers you have to write mm-hmm. for every single, and in American studies, you had to write a paper a week. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely loved it. Mm-hmm. It was as though, although I didn't realize it, I wouldn't have said this at the time, but I look back on it, and it was as though I was made for that journey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who knew? That was the farthest thing. You would never have convinced me mm-hmm. as a kid or while I was at Purdue that one day that's who I would become. That's how my life would change. But it introduced me to what became the rest of my life wow. as a writer.
Well, you know, it's for me, I don't know that I'd say I love to write. That's something I've pondered a lot over the last few years. I mean, there are times when I feel like overcome with it where I need to write. Mm-hmm. And I've never been the person you described who just agonized over writing. It always just came to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't struggle with it like other people did. And it just, like, to me, it was almost like putting a jigsaw puzzle together or something.
Uh-huh.
Just fitting pieces together. And, you know, but yeah, I can relate. With that.
Do you know how lucky? Yeah, you know how lucky you and I are that it works that way for us
yeah.
because most people do agonize.
I know. Even
people who are great writers who have published a lot talk about the agony
right.
of writing. And I look at writing as nourishment.
Right.
You know?
Well, I will say that that's something that I never quite resonated with me. Because, you know, like Hemingway has quotes about something about bleeding all over the page. Or, you know, yeah. there are all these quotes about that.
Right.
But I am at a place where I feel compelled to write about really difficult, painful stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard to sit down and do it. You know, the really tough stuff.
Right.
It's hard to sit down and do it. But also, one of the things I've learned is I used to beat myself up for not having written a book yet for a long time, like many years. And and finally, it hit me about 5 years ago, you know, you couldn't write the book you need to write. You needed to go through what you needed to go through in order to write the book that you're supposed to write. And something I write now, I couldn't have written 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
And I would rather write what I can write now than what I could have written then.
Oh, I so understand that. Yes.
Yeah. So it's really a funny thing, writing, you know. When do you write, Karen? What time of day?
You know, as I can really sit and write any time of day. But when I am working on a book, now this one is done. I've finished all of the editing process with the publisher. But when I write now, it's usually in the morning because it's real energizing for me. But, you know, when I wrote Each Day a New Beginning, for instance, you know, I didn't sit down to write a book for women. That was never my intention. And that was what has been such an interesting part of the journey for me as a writer, because that book was really my attempt to communicate with God, because I would go to AA meetings and feel a sense of comfort and well-being. I would feel part of the cocoon of AA, and then I would leave and go home to my one-bedroom apartment and feel absolutely, absolutely lost. And it felt as though I couldn't connect at all. And so I spent a lot of time struggling with that, and in fact, had had one very, very close suicide plan in place until it was interrupted by a knock at the door, quite an intentional knock, I know, I don't have any doubt. But it was the result of that that I knew I just had to keep reaching for God. And for me, it became apparent that to sit and open myself up to a conversation with God was the only way I would ever actually find a connection. And so I began to write, and that's what became Each Day a New Beginning. And you know, I would have to say, even over all of these 45 years, and I've written 30 books now.
Oh my goodness. I didn't realize you'd written that many books.
Yeah. I know best God's presence when I am writing. So probably, I remember when I saw the movie Frida, about Frida Kahlo. Painter. Yeah. Yes. And I remember, if you'll remember, at the very end, you know, she had such terrible, terrible back pain. And at the very end, she was laying on her side in bed, still painting. And I remember saying to my husband, you know, I have a feeling that that's me in old age. Oh, wow. I'm still going to be sitting someplace, maybe not leg on my side, but sitting someplace writing simply because I have to. And that is how it feels for my life. I can't imagine that I'll ever stop.
Wow. That's so great that you have that.
Yeah, I feel really, I don't doubt but what I have been called to do this. And that sounds, I hope our listeners don't think, well, that sounds weird, but it, you know, I think we're all called to do something.
Yeah.
I think that our purpose is quite intentional, and it does feel like this has been why I was born.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I never was able to have children, and I had many pregnancies, but I was never able to have children. And so I've always thought that, you know, I gave birth to books.
Well, I was going to say, there are authors who call them their children these days.
Yeah.
I see a lot.
Right. So it feels like I've had a whole house full of children.
Wow. Well, you know, it's funny because having written, like, from a journalistic standpoint prior to recovery, and then getting in recovery and, you know, seeing all these books that people write about their journey to recovery, right? To me, I always thought, I'm not doing that. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do the same thing everybody else is doing, first of all. And, you know, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to want to have an angle that somebody else doesn't.
Right.
And, you know, so it really, it's been this question for me. If I write, what do I write and why am I writing? And, mm-hmm. and I, in the beginning, I never wanted to have it be, I always felt like it needed to be in service. If I was going to mm-hmm. do it, it needed to be in service to another human being.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as the years have gone by, you know, I've working with clients, working with as a counselor with people or with groups or managing a facility, you know, the sphere of influence gets bigger, right? It just can, for me, it has continued to grow. And so, for me, the logical progression of that has become this podcast, my writing, so that I can help more people. That's
right.
It. That's the point, you know?
Yeah.
And it's funny because I've also, like, back to, like, seeing ourselves as experts, or me seeing myself as an expert and kind of struggling with that. If I write in this context, you know, what voice am I comfortable taking on? What's going to feel right to me? You know, we all, as writers, we have to find our voice.
Right.
And so I don't even really know how I stumbled upon it, but I realized a few years ago that writing the stuff that you're talking about writing comes naturally to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I submitted a book proposal at the end of 2019.
Wonderful. And I kind of, excellent.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of knew it was going to get, I didn't think it was going to get picked up. I've always felt like it's the second book.
Uh-huh.
The Daily Reader is the second book that will support whatever the first book is going to be, which I don't know yet, but I have written a number of daily meditations and it feels good, you know. And one of the things that I've tried to do, being someone who got sober young and working with young people, I feel, and being a writer, I'm really careful about the jargon I use or don't use.
Right.
And so part of what I've tried to do is write the lessons that I've learned in a way without using the recovery jargon.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, first of all, the young people who are trying to get sober, it doesn't scare them off.
Right.
But also, it's universal.
Right.
These are all things anyone can benefit from.
Sure.
And you know, when I've, most of what I've written, well, at first I thought maybe I want to write amends, and I've played with that. But, you know, that seems, to me, it seems like a way to limit myself, that I, you know, I don't necessarily need to do that. But you know, I'm still figuring it out. But sure. I love taking a quote and commenting on it for a couple paragraphs and coming up with an intention for it.
Well, that's great. And that's yeah, I encourage you to keep pursuing that.
I will.
That's yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. I'll send you a couple that I've written.
And, I'd love to see them.
Yeah, it's yeah, I have I'm an idea guy, you know.
Yeah.
I have lots of ideas, and you know, part of what I need to do is manage my time differently so that I can devote mornings to writing.
Uh-huh.
Right now I have to rearrange some things where I can, you know, I've been trying to manage my life so that I can afford to do that, so that I can, like, I can make money at different times of day so that the stuff that's going to take longer to yield an income, I can do.
Right.
But I'm getting to the point where I need to double down on the writing stuff and spend more time doing it. You know, what I really like to write more than anything is sort of personal essays.
Yeah.
And
that's what people love to read those.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I love Joan Didion's stuff.
Oh, yeah. I do too.
I mean, she is masterful.
She is.
She's just one of those writers that, I mean, I feel like I'm a pretty good writer, but I don't know if I could ever write like that.
Yeah. You know, well, like, few of us can.
Right. Right.
And she's just achingly honest,
you
know? Yeah.
Yeah, man. And, you know, that Slouching Toward Bethlehem, the essays in that book, just, some of the things she talks about, you know, and, you know, about self-respect and, you know, being married and those, I mean, just some of the, she comes out with some of the most uncanny but powerful sentences of anyone I've ever read. It just unexpected sort of statements that just are so strong.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we both love words, right?
Right.
I mean, it's like, that's either you do or you don't. And I'm definitely
that's
one
right.
of those people who just loves words.
Right.
Wow. So you just finished a book that comes out in May. And then do you have any other projects in the works, or where are you with it all now, Karen?
No, I don't. I'm sure that something will call to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have another project on the back burner right now. I think that because this one is on Amazon already to be released May 11th, but I'm sure something else is going to call soon thereafter. I just am not sure what that might be or how it might materialize.
Right, you just got to show up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So,
right,
do you write every day, regardless?
I used to. I don't write every day now. I mean, lots of times if I'm not writing anything in particular, I'll just sit down and write a Facebook post or something. Mm-hmm. I love writing every day just because it soothes. It really is soothing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I don't necessarily write every day. And actually with Zoom meetings, I have 12 different meetings that I go to a week on Zoom.
That's
so, and so that plus just preparation for life in general and, doing all the things that one does just to keep life going, takes a lot of time.
It does, doesn't it?
But writing is for me such a pleasurable activity so that there's never a sense of, oh gosh, I need to sit down and write. You know, that's never how it's felt to me, even from the very beginning. And, you know, when I think back in graduate school, and all of my friends would just moan and groan about writing papers. And I can still remember how I would look at that and think, my gosh, that's not my experience at all. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that whatever our experiences are, they really are leading us in the direction we need to go.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we have to pay attention to that stuff.
We do. And I think that it's easy to not pay attention.
Well, it's easy. Everyone has all their opinions about what they think we should do with our time.
Right, you know, right.
And this, you know, one of the things this podcast has made me question, I've always kind of thought, well, I wanted to write, and, you know, but I really, this just, like, I'm really enjoying this. I'm totally in the moment. I'm not anywhere else. You know, that's, it's not the same when I write. Now, sometimes right. I'm completely consumed with it when I really am inspired. But this I can just do, and it just it is a pleasure. And, you know, so I'm still figuring that out. But I'm more and more learning that when we see those cues, we have to follow them.
Or that's
we don't.
True.
We could choose not to, but we're better
right.
off if we follow
right.
them. I was
right.
sitting with a client a few years ago who, young guy, wanted to move out west, and he had a job with benefits and was maybe sober 3 or 4 years, and somebody sent him to me, and I was meeting with him once a week. And, well, you know, he just wanted to be like a park ranger or something. And, you know, well, he's talking to his dad, who said, well, you know, how are you going to make it? And, you know, what about benefits? And, you know, everywhere he went, he got discouraged from doing what he actually wanted to do.
Right.
And at some point, you know, I mean, I talked to him about you. That's what you want.
Right.
You deserve it.
Right.
And I said, and I, you know, I mean, this was not of me. This was through me, but I told God gave you that.
Right.
What you want, God gave you that.
Right.
And, you know, he got really quiet for a couple minutes and kind of looking down, and I realized he started crying. And
yeah.
And you okay? And he said, I just never thought about that before.
Yeah.
And you know what he did?
He went out
that
west.
Was the last time I saw him. Instead, he went out and got a second job delivering pizzas until he had the money to go move out west.
Oh,
and
good
now
for
he's
him.
Out west.
You yeah. know?
That makes me feel good.
Yeah.
To have had that, be able to be there for someone like that.
Right.
That's really what it's about, you know?
That is what it's about. However we guide somebody else, as long as we are listening to our higher power
right.
And offer the guidance that we're hearing, however we then pass that on, I think is what completes the circle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so easy, especially with substance abuse and the stigma, and to think about, well, this is about, you know, there's something wrong with somebody, and you know, we're trying to help them get better. And I don't really see it that way. You know, I mean, I see it as this is about you having a better life.
Right.
That's really what it's about.
Right.
And if you have a better life, you're not going to want to destroy yourself.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So, well, Karen, I could just go on talking to you forever.
Oh, thank you.
I want to stay in touch, too, definitely.
Okay.
So, looking back on all this, well, first I got to ask you, what high school did you go to?
Oh, I went to Jefferson High School. And we, Kokomo High School and Jefferson High School were huge.
North Central Conference.
Oh, yeah. Huge battles.
Yes.
Huge battles.
Yes.
You know, my nephew, I mean, my, let's see, my cousin, Mike Paul, used to be the football coach at Kokomo High School.
Mike Paul. How long ago was that?
Oh, well, you know, he would be now, let's see, I'm 82. Right now, I'm sure he would be 70.
Okay.
So he probably has retired, but he was the football coach there for a long time in Kokomo.
Wow. Well, so, I mean, he probably would have been while I was there. If he's 70. I graduated in 91.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I would think that he probably was. Yeah.
I remember, you know, the principal's name was Kennedy, and he had family members who also coached wrestling and football. And, you know, I'm drawing a blank on the football coaches. I played baseball.
Okay.
And of course, in Indiana, I mean, I could tell you who our high school basketball coach was.
Oh, that was Basil Malby. Oh, my gosh.
But the football coach, I can't remember, you know.
Yeah,
but,
Indiana high school basketball. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when I tell people I covered high school sports, I mean, I got to cover high school basketball in Indiana when it was still one class. I mean, I got to meet Bobby Plump. Crump. Which one? Is it Plump or Crump? You know who I'm talking about, right?
I'm thinking of Bobby Knight.
Well, no, I'm talking about the guy who hit the shot at Milan High School to win the game, which eventually the movie Hoosiers was based on.
Oh!
You remember the little town of Milan, which is not far from...
Yeah, right, and that was such a wonderful movie. Yes.
Yeah, and but, you know, it's based on a true story about that little tiny town. And that guy, Bobby Plump, hit that shot, and... shot underhand against Oscar Robertson's high school team. That was
something. That was quite a movie. A wonderful true story.
Well, and I think it did a pretty good job of capturing the atmosphere of what high school basketball is in Indiana. I came to Florida thinking, well, Florida's known for football. I'm going to cover some football, and that'll be, man, not even close. Not even close. And growing up in, you know, I'm sure Lafayette Jeff is what we called it. The gym is probably similar to ours. I mean, my high school gymnasium seated over 5,000 people.
Yeah.
Like, it's bigger than college.
Right.
Gymnasiums. And
man,
it was a big deal. Basketball.
It was a huge deal.
But you know what, where it was even a bigger deal? The smaller the town.
Oh, that's true. All the townspeople.
Oh my gosh. It was so intense, and people got so fired up, and I miss, like, walking into the gymnasium on a Friday or Saturday night and smelling the popcorn and hearing the pep band and it was just so much fun. It really was
so much fun. That brings back so many wonderful memories. Yeah.
And of course, I have, some of my first, like, drinking escapades in high school. When Kokomo was really good, when I was a sophomore in high school, and we went to the Lafayette semi-state, which was at Mackey.
Oh, Mackey Arena, over at Purdue.
Yep, and won. So, and we ended up losing in the championship game. In Indiana, the Final Four is like, it's practically like the collegiate Final Four.
It's on TV. You're right.
It's, at least then it was really, and they played it all in one day. And we ended up losing to Lawrence Central. And Eric Montross was the center who went on to North Carolina and NBA. And then Todd Leary, who was a prolific guard at Indiana and just a lights out shooter. I mean, we weren't going to beat them. We had a couple injuries, but it's such a cool experience.
Yeah.
And, some of those little schools, I mean, winning a sectional for them, people would talk about it for a lifetime.
Right. Yeah, it was a huge, huge deal. You're right. You're right.
Really a special sort of atmosphere to grow up in. And it's one of the things, there's a sense of community around it.
That's so true.
That doesn't exist where I live. Not really. You know, and I do miss that. I miss that collective experience. Like, I'm sure growing up in Indiana, you can remember how, you know, the 500, we could never watch it on TV because it was blacked out. So growing up, Memorial Day weekend on race day, I mean, I'd be riding my bike around the neighborhood and there would never be a point when I didn't hear the race.
Yes.
Somebody had it on the radio.
Somebody had it on the radio.
It was just, and it was the whole month of May. It was.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, there are a lot of special things about it. I like my life now. I think I'm not meant to live in Kokomo, Indiana my whole life, and I'm happy I left, but there are some great things about growing up in that part of the country
that is true. I can relate to that completely. Yeah. I still have family there in Lafayette.
Yeah.
And I have.
When's the last time you've been?
Oh, yeah. Every time we leave Florida, we go through Lafayette and stay with some family.
Okay.
So, and about 10 or 12 years ago, we built a log cabin outside of Lafayette, real close to where my niece and her husband live. Yeah. And then we ended up, because we knew we would spend time there. And when I inherited money from my mother when she died, I felt like I wanted to just take that money and leave it in Indiana. Mm-hmm. So we bought this land and ended up building a log cabin, which my young great niece lives in now with her family. Wow. So, yeah. Are well rooted still. Yeah. In the Lafayette area. Well, yeah.
Most of my, I'm the youngest of eight. They're all in Kokomo. I have some family down here, they're almost all there. And my mom, who, one of the things I wanted to do, Karen, is, you know, having had that experience with you when you inscribed that book for my mom, I've been talking to her about being on the podcast. And so I wanted to do this and do the episode with you before I had her on. But I'm looking forward to that a lot. That's going to be a special thing to do with.
Oh, absolutely. Let me know when that is.
I will.
Where definitely. I can tune in. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, so looking back over all this, did I already ask you that question?
No, you started.
I started, didn't I?
Right.
I mean, here we go. I mean, like I said, I can just talk forever. So looking back over the course of your life, if there was a time when you could give the younger Karen a word of advice or support, when would you have needed that? And what would you go back and say to her?
You know, it probably goes back to when I was really young and very afraid and didn't understand. I took my first drink at 13 and suddenly it felt like somehow things were going to be okay. But if I could have, I would have said to her, you know, you don't maybe need to do that. You will be okay. And yet I wouldn't change the trajectory of my life for anything. But I think that the best advice I could ever have given me is to say, you know, you are being constantly comforted by a presence greater than yourself, because I didn't believe that. I wasn't raised, in a family that practiced, religion of any kind. I mean, I think that everybody believed in God, but nobody talked about it. And nobody said grace before a meal except the big family gatherings when my drunk uncle would be called on to say grace. Mm-hmm. But I never had that sense that somebody was watching out for me. And I think that I'm struck all the time by the beauty of the epilogue in the Course in Miracles, where it talks about the hovering angels surrounding us. And I think that had I been able to, I would have said, you know, there are hovering angels and you're going to be just fine. Just take a deep breath and keep moving forward.
Wow. Well, that's beautiful. Thank you so much, Karen.
Oh, you're so welcome. Yeah. Okay. It has been a treat for me, too. So thank you, Tom.
All right, there you have it. Karen Casey, hope you enjoyed it. This has been one of several episodes. The past few episodes have all been kind of just a lot of focus on addiction and recovery, or the need for recovery and family. And so, but the next episode is going to feature an interior designer turned coach named Jesse Carroll, who lives out in Texas. So it'll be a little change of pace. So if you enjoyed this or any other episode, please take the time to leave a rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, wherever it is you listen, whatever it is they allow you to do to show love, please do. Every little bit helps. If you have questions or comments, you can call 561-247-4757 to leave a message. I might even use it on the show. I'd love to hear from you. Value any feedback you have to offer. For early access to this and every other episode, you can support the show on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Early access to episodes. When I finished this interview with Karen, I posted it right away, unedited. I do something I call the Saturday Dispatch, which is a little short episode that I do for patrons on Saturdays. Usually do some kind of reading or something. So I try to come up with some added value for folks. And really, I just want to get to the point where I can devote more time and energy to this project. Really enjoying it. I loved doing the episode with my mom. I hope you guys enjoyed that. So, I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. The Path to Authenticity is proud to support the I Speak Media Foundation. Thank you to our sponsors, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. And as always, thank you to Wendy Chin at Equivox for her digital support. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. Please check out the website. Join our mailing list. thepathtoauthenticity.com. So I hope you guys enjoyed this. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. I realize that there are a lot of ways you can invest your time. So thank you. Have a great week. Be nice. Thank you.
Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.